It's not a problem that ends once a kid makes it out of the hospital.
State health officials warn about a big increase in infant opiate addictions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 22nd. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, Senator Lisa Murkowski tells the Alaska legislature if it wants Medicaid expansion, it should have it.
Alaska should have that option, so I will not vote to repeal it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Join Alaskan leaders for an online discussion about civility in the last frontier Thursday, February 23rd from 5:30 to 7 at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says it's too early to judge the Trump presidency. She's been skeptical of some of his actions, but in her annual address to the Alaska legislature this morning, Murkowski presented the Trump administration as an opportunity for resource development.
So here's the plan in this new administration, this new Congress. We're going to start here in Alaska by working to restore throughput in our Trans-Alaska pipeline. It is possible, and it will be done.
During the campaign, Murkowski called for Trump to leave the ticket. She's one of only four Republicans to vote against any of his cabinet nominees so far. But Democrats who hope Murkowski will help them block the Trump agenda might be disappointed in her speech and what she told reporters afterwards.
I am looking at the Trump administration and the team that he's putting together and saying, how can we be working to best advantage Alaskans?
Murkowski says she's been encouraged so far by Trump's resource policies. While environmentalists warn that EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt will dismantle the agency, Murkowski says he'll bring the EPA back to its lawful mission. With reporters, Murkowski wasn't entirely uncritical of the Trump administration.
I do think that that there have been some instances where, as a team, they kind of stepped in it. And I think we saw that with the initial rollout of the executive order on the travel ban.
On the other hand, she says the Trump team flawlessly handled the announcement of Trump's pick for the Supreme Court. Invited to provide a general assessment of the Trump White House, Murkowski demurred.
Ask me that question in 3 months.
On health care, the senator says Congress should take time to craft a good replacement for the Affordable Care Act. She says the new program should retain features like coverage for pre-existing conditions and mental health parity. And she told legislators she supports continuing the Medicaid expansion, the cost of which is now largely borne by the federal government.
So as long as this legislature wants to keep the expansion, Alaska should have that option. So I will not vote to repeal it.
If that disappointed conservative lawmakers, so did her next statement about Planned Parenthood. Many of her Republican colleagues want to bar Planned Parenthood from receiving Medicaid money for any medical services because its clinics provide abortions. Murkowski says the Planned Parenthood controversy doesn't belong in the debate over health care replacement plan.
Taxpayer dollars should not be used to pay for abortions, but I will not vote to deny Alaskans access to the health services that Planned Parenthood provides. So
that applause was not universal. Republican Senator, State Senator John Coghill of North Pole says he gives Murkowski high marks for standing up for Alaska.
On the Planned Parenthood issue, her and I just totally disagree. But it's always good to see her take the work so thoughtfully.
Alaska's other U.S. Senator, Dan Sullivan, is due to address the legislature on Friday. Alaska moved a step closer today to permanently filling the position of Attorney General. The House Judiciary Committee forwarded Jenna Lindemuth to a joint session of the legislature to be confirmed. She's been the acting Attorney General since Craig Richards resigned in June. Wasilla Republican David Eastman was the sole lawmaker who objected to advancing Lindemuth's nomination. Eastman says he believes Lindemuth showed too much deference to the state Supreme Court, a court Eastman claims has overstepped its responsibilities on some issues. A new study from a state epidemiologist looks at babies who were exposed to opiates before birth. Unlike previous studies, it goes beyond the sharp rise in cases for a portion of the population to explore what happens next. Alaska Public Media's Anne Hillman found out more about what we know and what we don't.
When looking at the study, the first thing that jumps out are the numbers. From 2004 to 2015, there was a seven-fold increase in the rate of neonatal abstinence syndrome. That's when babies are in withdrawal from drugs after being born. In 2004, fewer than 3 out of every 1,000 live births were impacted. In 2015, it was just over 18. But these numbers do not reflect the entire state. Abigail Newby-Cue is a maternal and child health epidemiologist with the state, and she completed the report. She says the study only looks at Medicaid-eligible births because that's the most complete long-term data set available, and you can't use it to draw conclusions about rates for the entire population. She says the study has other limitations, too, because NAS isn't always diagnosed the same way in each hospital.
The symptoms vary greatly based on just the type of drug that the mother was using, the amount of the drug that the mother was using. It's very possible that an infant might not display symptoms until they're already outside the hospital. In that case, the hospital could miss it entirely.
The study does mirror national trends. The number of kids born with opioids in their systems is on the rise. And then it goes a step further to see what happens to the babies once they leave the hospital.
It's not a problem that ends once a kid makes it out of the hospital. Both the child and the mother are going to need additional support down the line.
Newby-Cue says that at the moment, there aren't many ways to find out what happens to these families, but one available data set is from the Office of Children's Services. Federal and state laws require medical providers to report children who are prenatally exposed to substances to Child Protection Services, though not all do. There were 541 cases diagnosed during the 12-year-long study period. It's unknown if the mothers were using the drugs legally or not. Nearly two-thirds of the cases were reported to the Office of Children's Services, and about 140 kids were temporarily or permanently taken from their homes. OCS Operations Manager Travis Erickson says the agency does not automatically remove a child from a home where people are using substances.
When there's substances involved, we assess the impact of those substances on the parent's ability to caregive for the children. And so we're really looking beyond, is there substances being used, to things like how does that change the parent's behavior?
He says the assessments include talking to medical providers and law enforcement agencies and seeing what sort of safety nets the family has in place. He says there's a well-known rise in opioid use statewide. The governor recently declared it a public health disaster. But for OCS,
alcohol is still by far and away the most common underlying substance that causes child abuse and neglect.
Epidemiologist Newby-Cue says the long-term impacts of prenatal exposure to opioids is still unknown and needs more research. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
The deaths of two Soldotna residents found in a burned truck in November have been ruled accidental. According to an Alaska State Trooper dispatch released this morning, carbon monoxide inhalation was a factor in the deaths. 39-year-old Daniel Duck and 52-year-old Joni Percy, both of Soldotna, were reported missing in late November. Alaska State Troopers located the two bodies a week later inside a burned Ford Bronco in a wooded area near where they were last seen. A number of organizations contributed to the investigation, including Alaska State Troopers, the State Medical Examiner's Office, and the State Fire Marshal. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, looking back 20 years at a deadly high school shooting in Bethel.
I went in there with the intent of putting the shotgun in my mouth and killing myself.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Alaska National Parks can hire the hundreds of seasonal employees they need to keep up with summer operations. Seasonal staffing was thrown into limbo when President Donald Trump ordered a federal hiring freeze in January. As KHNS's Emily Files reports, after about a month of questions and waiting, Alaska National Parks can now get to work hiring summer staff.
Mike Trunnell is superintendent of the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park in Skagway. In December and January, the Klondike Park was interviewing summer job applicants as usual. But before they were able to make final job offers,
we just had to tell them that it's on hold for now until we get final approval.
That's because the parks weren't sure how their summer hires would be impacted by a federal hiring freeze President Trump announced shortly after he took office. On January 31st, the Pentagon announced exemptions to the freeze, including seasonal and temporary staff, quote, necessary to meet traditionally recurring seasonal workloads. But it wasn't until late last week that National Parks got the final green light. The Park Service needed to get seasonal hiring plans approved by the Federal Office of Management and Budget. A Park Service spokesperson says on Friday, the OMB granted that approval.
So now we're able to go back to them and officially offer them the job.
Again, Superintendent Trunnell. The Klondike Park's operations in the winter versus the summer are like night and day. That's true for a lot of national parks. In Skagway, nearly a million cruise ship visitors come to town each summer. The park is a big piece of the infrastructure that educates and entertains visitors, giving tours of historic Skagway and overseeing the popular Chilkoot Trail. It takes about 30 seasonal staff and 30 year-round employees.
You know, we have about half or even slightly more than half of our employees overall are seasonal, so it's obviously a very important part of our staff, and we're looking forward to having them be here on time, ready to go, so we're all ready for that first ship day.
About 70 miles south of Skagway is Glacier Bay National Park. The superintendent there, Philip Hoogie, found out Monday that he would be able to hire about 70 summer employees.
It was exciting to see that. Exciting to see that we're going to be open for business here this summer and our quite large operation.
Glacier Bay, like Skagway, serves hundreds of thousands of cruise ship visitors during the summer. But the interaction is different. Instead of the ship docking and passengers going on land, park rangers are shuttled on board the ships to give talks there. Hoogie says he thought the seasonal workers would be approved eventually because they are so vital to National Parks operations. But he says the delay caused by the hiring freeze may mean some of their top candidates took jobs elsewhere.
We know that when we go out to do offers, some of the people that we would have liked to catch will have found other positions because of the delay.
Both Hoogie and Trunnell say the month of uncertainty caused by the hiring freeze was inconvenient, but it won't hurt their ability to hire enough staff for the summer. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
February 19th, 1997. 16-year-old Evan Ramsey took a shotgun to Bethel High School and opened fire in the lobby just as school was about to start. Principal Ron Edwards and student Josh Palacios were killed. Rhonda McBride, who worked for KYUK at the time of the shooting, has more.
Today, Evan Ramsey is 36, an inmate at the Goose Creek Correctional Center, about a 90-minute drive from Anchorage.
There's a part of me that will always be sad.
Sad for you or sad for what you did?
Sad for what I did, but the small amount of sorrow that I have, others feel much more.
How many victims did you have on your list?
Four. There were four people that I intended on shooting.
And why? What had they done that was so bad they deserved to be killed?
There were people that if they would see me, they would pick on me.
Was the principal on the list? Ron Edwards?
No.
Was Josh Palacios on the list?
No, Josh was not. I struggle with that a lot because I had nothing against him. I didn't really know him.
I live it every day. It's, I wish you could shut the door on it.
Claudia Palacios waited a long day for a medevac to arrive and watched her son Josh die en route to Anchorage.
A lot of people say, you have to just let that go. And, I've just never learned how to let go of Joshua.
Palacios left Bethel and eventually returned. She says she still hasn't been back to the high school, where she'd like to see the memorial in the lobby for her son and Ron Edwards, but she just can't.
I see people wearing warrior colors and a warrior cap, and Josh so loved, you know, the game, and it's painful. It's just really painful.
Josh was known for his big smile. He was a popular basketball star. Palacio says her son Josh always brought kids in need of a safe place to stay to their home. She wished that Evan Ramsey had been one of them. Then maybe he wouldn't have brought a gun to school.
I had a plan of action. I was 100% sure that when I was in high school, after firing the gun, that the students and everybody would sit down and be still and listen to me. I went in there with the intent of putting the shotgun in my mouth and killing myself.
Ramsey says kids spit on him, kicked him, called him Screech after a geek in the TV series Saved by the Bell. Now, he wanted them to know how much it hurt. Two boys helped him plan the shooting. Others were told something spectacular would happen, and they showed up in the balcony above the lobby to watch.
What would you say to Claudia Palacios, Josh's mom?
I'm sorry. I wish I could change what happened. I understand my apology will probably not mitigate anything.
I wanted to know why. You know, that was like the question you ask, you know, all these years. Why me? Why Josh? Why?
Do you have an answer for the why?
No. No.
Does it matter?
No. When I was asking the question, I thought it mattered, but it doesn't matter.
What matters?
That it doesn't happen again.
But it has, over and over, Pearl, Paducah, Columbine, and others. For KYUK, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Seventy years ago today, the Bureau of Indian Affairs opened Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka. FBIA and other boarding institutions that operated in Alaska until the 1980s left some students traumatized, while others say it saved their lives. Alumni from Mount Edgecombe say their alma mater managed to avoid the darkest parts of that legacy. It opened as a public boarding school in 1985, and as KCAW's Emily Russell reports, a lot has changed over the decades.
Leanne Francis mixes the last bag of berries into a massive stainless steel bowl. It's Sunday night at Mount Edgecombe, and students line up for the sweet treat known as agoutik, or Eskimo ice cream, Francis explains.
You just, like, mix the lard together until it gets fluffy, and then you add in the sugar until it's, like, sort of dissolved, and then you add the berries.
Francis is a junior from Pilot Station, a Yupik village on the Yukon River. They eat agoutik there, but she says they add in some local flair.
In Pilot Station, we use white fish. You just do the same things, but you just add in the fish.
There's a lot of native cultures who do the same thing, who take dried meat, cooked meat, and add berries to it.
Rachel Moreno is the cultural activities coordinator at Mount Edgecombe.
Some people put in a little bit of flaked halibut. Some add caribou meat.
The Edgecombe version of a gudeg is dished out every Sunday in the school's culture room. It's cluttered in here, but in a cozy way. There are glass jars full of beads and endless spools of thread scattered about. 70 years ago, though, there was no culture room. It barely even had classrooms.
The classroom, there were no chairs, no desks, no chalkboards, so we sat on the floor.
Gil Truitt was a student back in 1947. He moved from the Wrangell Institute, another BIA-run boarding school at the time. Wrangell was his first time away from home.
To me, that was really the beginning of my life, because I saw what a boarding school could be and what it could do.
Truitt was orphaned at 14. He says the BIA, it saved him and his siblings, and he says others share that sentiment, that boarding schools spared them from abuse or neglect at home. But there's another side to that story, the side that says the BIA punished kids for speaking their native language, that kids were beaten and some even sexually abused. When asked about the history of abuse at BIA schools, Truitt defends both he attended.
I know of no time at Edgecombe or Wrangell where you were beaten for violating the rules.
I saw lots of sexual violence, a lot of physical violence.
Jim LaBelle was sent to the Wrangell Institute when he was just 8 years old. Those are dark days, LaBelle says. He went on to Mount Edgecombe in 1961.
How did life compare at the Wrangell Institute versus Mount Edgecombe?
Oh my gosh. It was kind of like turning on a light.
Like Gil Truitt, LaBelle looks back on his days at Edgecombe with a real fondness. They both say it felt like family there. A 2005 survey by UAA's Institute for Social and Economic Research did report one allegation of sexual assault and three of sexual harassment at Mount Edgecombe. But neither Truitt nor LaBelle had memories of that. LaBelle also doesn't remember any students being punished at Edgecombe for speaking their native language like they were at Wrangell. It wasn't exactly celebrated, though.
There weren't any instructions in our culture, in our language. It was all reading and writing and arithmetic.
They still teach reading, writing, and math at Mount Edgecombe, but there's this, too.
I yurok sometimes.
Which is what?
Which is Eskimo dancing or Yupik dancing.
Geraldine Alexi is a senior from Pitkiss Point, a place so small she usually tells people she's from St. Mary's, the village of 600 people just up the river.
I make like gus bucks or earrings. I try to make moccasins, but I didn't have the patience to do that.
Sophomore Shelby Samuel's hometown is even smaller, Platinum, a village of just 55 people north of Bristol Bay.
I get homesick once in a while. Like sometimes I'll wake up like really homesick.
Samuel says hunting is what he misses the most.
But then I'll do something, like I'll come here to the culture room and yurok. I always wanted to learn how to yurok, Yupik dance, and then I'm finally learning how.
Here's the irony. Platinum, Samuel says, it's too small to have Yupik dancing. But he's able to learn about that and other parts of his culture here at Mount Edgecombe, more than 1,000 miles from home. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Russell.
Sea ice extent in the waters off Antarctica reached a record low last week. That bucks the recent trend of increasing sea ice off the continent. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with climatologist Brian Brentschneider each week as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. This week, we're responding to a listener who asked whether sea ice in Antarctic waters has been generally increasing while the Arctic ice has seen dramatic declines.
The answer to the question, the short answer is yes, there's been a trend the last decade or so of increasing sea ice surrounding Antarctica. But from a climate point of view, that's really far less significant than the decline that we've seen in the Arctic. And even if you add the two together, the overall trend is a reduction in global sea ice. Now, having said that, this summer, and I remember it's summer down in the Southern Hemisphere, they just achieved a record low sea ice extent for any year, for any date, since they've been keeping satellite records since 1979. Obviously, that's not hundreds of years of records, but that's what we have. So not only do we have record low in the Arctic, daily records being set pretty much every day, but we've just set an all-time record low in the Antarctic. So it's really, it's bad all around.
So there may be a trend of increasing sea ice in Antarctic waters, but this year is a different story.
This year is a different story. It is a record low surrounding Antarctica. But again, remember, the climate effects are vastly different. And so it's not a zero-sum game. You don't just add Arctic sea ice and Antarctic sea ice, and then that's your ice-climate equation. The climate effects are vastly different, and Arctic sea ice is far more significant from a global climate perspective.
What accounts for that increasing trend, though?
There's actually an active area of research about why there's been an increase in sea ice over the last 10 or 15 years on average. And some of the theories are that because there's been a lot of glacial melt around the periphery of Antarctica, that's kind of flooding the ocean with fresh water, which has a higher freezing point. So it's easier to freeze that. There's also some discussion about the jet stream pattern, the circumpolar jet stream at about 60 degrees south latitude, and how that is kind of preventing, at certain times of year, low pressure areas from generating large swells and kind of breaking up the ice. So it makes it a little bit more resilient.
Brian Brent-Schneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rhonda McBride in Bethel, Emily Russell in Sitka, Shayla Farzan in Homer, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Emily Files in Haines, and Annie Feit and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Mr. Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. Lori Townsend is our news director. And I am Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The Bristol Bay Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Naknek February 28th and March 1st at Dolly's Hall from 8:30 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.